I just wonder if people heard it.
Well.
Is this the episode started?
Not yet.
Okay, because the funniest moment from last episode was probably the cold open.
Mm-hmm.
So if anybody missed it, they should go back and listen to the cold open. Turn the volume.
Yet. We haven't started.
You're yet. Not even recording?
I'm recording.
But I'm just saying this because maybe you should just go back and listen to it.
Okay. I might go back and listen. I don't remember what happened. What happened?
You said daddy's watching.
That's the thing is, I didn't mean I'm daddy doing the watching. I meant my daddy's watching.
Yes, absolutely. Well,
that was confusing to some people.
No.
Lena was, what's going on? Lena, my wife.
She's German.
Hello and welcome to the Two Hosers Photo Show. This is episode 41. And as once again, I'm back in Vancouver. So sitting across the table from me live in person is...
Adam.
Say hello, Adam.
Hello, Adam.
All right. That could be less awkward. Like, I can see how it would be better, more awkward on Skype.
Yeah, I like Skype. It's anonymity.
Your original plan was to do Skype... Despite the fact that we're in the same city.
Yeah, that's right.
That's crazy.
Is the audio better this way?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
The audio sound good to me.
Yeah.
With Skype, so.
I have no problems. Well, we do a secret Skype move I can't talk about.
You do it. I don't do it.
Yeah, you do nothing. You contribute nothing.
Except provide a lot of, yeah, uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I'm kind of watching something.
See, that's
window.
The thing. Now I can't, you know, look at three different things on my computer screen. And
you're wearing pants.
And I'm forced, yeah, exactly, and I'm forced to wear pants and pay attention. All things I'm not used to doing.
Well, what did you shoot?
This weekend?
This week. What did you shoot since the last time we talked?
A lot of off-camera stuff. So I had a trip to the park on the weekend with my kids and took a lot of pictures with them at the park. But because they're on playground equipment, I came up with a new invention. Maybe you've tried this where you have your wife hold one of the flashes and you tell her where to position it as you take pictures of your children. So works out well. They do get tired of holding it and they throw it back at you after a few minutes and you have to find another holder. So I had multiple holders at the park. So. Mm-hmm. And the pictures that we took at the park, I was quite pleased with. So if you can manage to get yourself a holder, I think there's a lot of potential there for good pictures.
You know what the technical term is?
No.
It's a VAL, a VAL.
What does that mean?
Voice activated light stand.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you come up with that?
No.
Oh.
No, I wish I had.
I like it.
Yeah. So that's what you can tell your wife she is. We shot some barbecue stuff yesterday.
That's right.
We had a barbecue at the Casa del, my dad's house.
Yeah.
That's Spanish, in case you missed that.
And you actually hired a photographer.
Did I? You?
Yeah.
That's true. You came out and shot some photos. Not as many as I would have expected, because I guess you were burned out from the day before.
Yeah, I didn't shoot too many.
But pictures. Yeah, no, we've had just ridiculously good weather here.
We have.
Like, this is beyond Indian summer.
Middle of October and those...
That's not offensive, right?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But middle of October, both weekend days where, I don't know, it felt like it was in the 70s.
We were wearing t-shirts.
Yeah.
In October, so that was nice.
Tight t-shirts, too.
Wow.
Just to keep the heat in.
Yeah, that's how we do it. So we had a barbecue, a lot of friends and their kids all came over to my dad's house and...
Burgers.
Homemade burgers.
Homemade french fries.
Homemade french fries as well.
Bouncy castle. Some guy brought a bouncy castle to the party.
Some guy, one of our friends.
Yeah.
Just some random dude.
Well, I just don't want to call anybody's name out.
Okay, it's Brad Pitt. Yeah. I'll say it. My friend Brad Pitt and Angelina came over.
And they had a bouncy castle.
And they had a... I guess they could afford a bouncy castle.
Yeah.
Yeah. So...
Took some pictures.
I don't
there.
Like hanging out with Brad anymore. Because when me and Pitt go out, all of a sudden I'm the funny one. You know?
That's gotta get annoying.
He's the hot one and he's the funny guy.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't get you chicks.
No.
So, so photo challenge. Let's move on. It wasn't the Brad Pitt. Did I mention that?
Right.
It was a Brad Pitt.
It was a Brad Pitt, yeah.
So, photo challenge.
Yep.
What did we do? We had Leaf. I think you remember the challenge better than I, even though it was my decree.
I think we were talking a lot about fall colors, and then I was actually surprised by the challenge because I thought it was going to be more of a fall colors picture, but then the actual challenge issued because I listened to the podcast from last week.
Well, you're the guy.
Yeah, I listened to it. I brought our numbers up a little bit, and it was to take a leaf picture with no other specification, but it was supposed to be a single leaf.
Right, which I did.
And I did as well. So maybe what should we talk about first?
Well, the reason I thought about that is because oftentimes, you know, your instinct is to go shoot all the leaves.
Yeah.
And include everything. And so this was kind of a way to encourage you to basically shoot fall colors in the context of fall. And only have it at the... You know what? That made a lot more sense in my head.
Yeah.
And then it kind of got... derailed.
I got lost in your eyes.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the pictures then.
Okay.
Let's start with yours.
That what we're looking at right there is a picture of a maple leaf. So I was looking specifically for a very red maple leaf for my picture. I found it, and I actually positioned it near the base of a tree. And I took that picture. There's some leaves and some grass in the background that you can see. And that's it. Pretty plain and simple. I like the texture from the tree mixed with the red maple leaf. But yeah, that's pretty much it. Now, I had a slightly greener version of this picture. And when I put it in, you suggested that it might be a little bit of a better contrast to make that picture a little, I guess, a little bit more blue in the background. Is that the adjustment that you ended up making?
Yeah, you sent me the raw. I asked you to send me the raw file, and I didn't make it more blue, although I did shift the color balance, the white balance, slightly.
Okay.
Not very much. I think you had it around 5,900. Kelvin, and I put it to about 5,700, but that was more so for the tone of the tree.
Okay, yeah.
But the background, what I ended up doing is I don't know how it works for you, but as I've mentioned many times on the show, I am red-green colorblind, and a lot of people kind of can have issues with it so that the red doesn't exactly pop out from the green.
Right.
And so for me, it really doesn't. For me, it blends in quite well. So what I did was... I pulled down the saturation on just the green channel.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Pulled down the green, and that way the red stayed, and so it kind of popped out more.
Yeah.
So the focus became more about the leaf versus the background.
Yeah, and I understand why you did that. So that's it. That's my leaf picture. Why don't you give me your critique?
Let's have a look. I like it.
That was lit. So that was an off-camera flash to the left. I tried to really... make it look not like it was off-camera flash, mm-hmm. but there's an umbrella and a flash really, really lighting that from maybe, I don't know, 6 or 7 feet.
Now that you say it, it does look like it because you see a little bit of the highlights on the leaf itself.
Yes.
But
yeah.
I never would have guessed. I assumed it was just kind of lit by sunlight.
Yeah, I tried to tone the flash down, but I did like the light that came off the leaf. So I did I think I had one I also took without the flash, and I preferred this one. So there it is.
Yeah, I like it because it tells you, you know what season this was taken in.
Yep.
And very, very simple and in context. So let's look at the one that was your runner-up.
Yeah.
I think this is a better photo.
I also think it is, but it didn't jump out at me as necessarily a leaf picture. So mm-hmm. I knew it was a leaf, but I thought if I put that picture as my primary choice, so I thought it might not be construed right away as a leaf, and I didn't want this to be an abstract picture, so I went with the more obvious choice. But I guess there's a little bit to be gained from sort of understanding how I took it, because I think it's a neat picture. If not the greatest leaf picture.
Oh, I agree. I think this is a great looking photo. I guess that's the sunset in the background.
Yeah. So the sun was exactly is the background, and you can sort of see the horizon line where it was bright enough to get that ambient light. And then what I did was, again, this is a off camera flash in an umbrella from above, and I've got it really, really close to that leaf, and I basically dropped all the ambient light out. I think I shot it on ISO 100, and it says at like 7 o'clock, so other than the light coming in the sunset, there's almost no ambient light left. And then I shot it at like an f2.2 or f2.0. So I got a shallow kind of, I guess, I don't know what you call it, but a shallow lighting depth of field. Would that be an appropriate term? So it drops off with the light because it's so close. Right. Yeah.
Very quick drop.
And then
off,
also a shallow depth of field as from the lens and the aperture that I've set it at. So you see like that leaf, I wanted to kind of create a fall, like as a leaf kind of falling picture. So I perched it kind of right on the edge of like a little wooden perch, I guess, is what it is. So you see the light hits the top of that perch and it hits the top of the leaf and then everything else drops out behind it. So that, and I like how the red stem kind of, you know, you see the real contrast from the
red
stem.
There you go. I did not see the red stem.
Oh, you can't actually see that?
I can now. Now that you pointed out, I see that that is red.
Yeah. So I really liked that line of contrast, and yeah, that's it. I liked the picture. It just didn't scream of a leaf picture to me.
This, exactly. I agree. This looks, because I don't know what color the leaf is, looks green to me.
Yeah.
It doesn't say autumn.
Yeah.
And because with a nice sunset, this seems like more of a late summer kind of midsummer pick. Great photo. I think it's a better photo, but not for this challenge.
Yeah, and it was a maple leaf, and you can't even really tell it. It's a maple leaf just based on the angle, and I really wanted my picture to say maple leaf.
Right.
Yeah.
You're from Toronto, right?
Yes. No. Obviously. Yeah, kind of.
Wait,
yeah.
No. Okay. Well, I'm glad you chose the other one.
Yeah.
But this one might make it up on your wall.
Maybe. So let's talk about yours.
This is the one I went with.
I love it.
Let's move on.
The only thing I have to say is that when I like the picture, I think it's kind of interesting because you chose a green maple leaf. And is that because you just wanted the contrast with the setting that you're putting it in?
Yeah, I chose a bright leaf on purpose. Also because the yellow ones were directly behind my house.
Right.
This was actually the day before I jumped on the airplane. And so I needed a run out while packing my bags, making sure my bag weighed exactly 23 kilos. I ran outside and snapped this photo. But I had this in mind the whole time. Like once the challenge was issued, I knew I wanted to shoot a leaf in the water.
Yeah.
Because and we have a little creek running behind our house, and so I went outside and set this up.
And this looks like it's lit because of the light coming off the log there, right?
Not lit.
Really?
Yeah.
That's just the sun.
Just the sun. I shot available light. I think I'd packed my flash stuff at that point.
Oh, okay.
All my stuff was packed up. So what I wanted to do is, first of all, is I wanted to find a certain set of colors that, to me, said autumn. So first of all, the kind of the wet log kind of says like that kind of wet time of year. The muted color palette, everything is really muted except for the leaf.
Okay, yeah.
That was on purpose. I also set the color balance so that the reflection, the sky being reflected in the water, would have a little bit of a blue tinge to it. I don't know if it does. It does to me.
I don't see it, but I'll take your word for
it. Okay, maybe not necessarily a blue tinge, but a cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Cooler light.
Yeah, yeah. It is. I'll agree with that.
And so that was the context I wanted to set, and then have the one bright leaf in the middle of that, so that you can see that the leaf doesn't take up a great deal of the photo, but I think it is still the central focal point.
Absolutely. Yep. That's where your eyes get drawn.
This was added. I added to this by purposely positioning the leaf in the shadow of the log. So you can see how there's the highlights in the water,
yeah,
and then the darkness, and then the highlights again. That's the shadow of the log.
Yeah.
So it's purposely placed right in between there.
Okay. Yeah, and I think it would have got lost a little bit if it had been placed back where the reflection is there. Yeah.
So that's the one I went with. I had a safety one because I wasn't 100% sure if this was going to register, so I wanted to get more of a close-up. And so that's the backup one.
Yeah, I like the other one. Definitely like the other one better.
Whew. I chose wisely.
Yeah, that one's just, nothing wrong with it. It's just a little more plain Jane.
It is a little bit, little bit less effort had gone into it. That's not true. I put enough effort in.
Yeah.
But it doesn't look like it. So we had a few really good entries this week. Let's talk about a couple of them.
Okay.
Derek, who we talked about on the show last week, who's
funny last name.
Well, not funny, haha.
No, it's funny because we're Canadian and anybody has a name like that is funny.
Yeah, if it's not McIntosh. Good Canadian name like McIntosh. Or whatever a typical Canadian name is.
I don't know.
No. Something Scottish.
Yeah, I don't know.
Can you play the bagpipes? All right, yeah. Canadian.
you get your pass.
Yeah, that's right. No, he said that he doesn't ever have time to submit a photo, and so us naming him and potentially shaming him, I don't know.
Yeah.
Now, boom, here he has. He submitted one.
Well, he did well with this picture.
It is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Raised the bar a little bit, I think.
Yeah, so we're probably not going to post ours because Derek's done a really good job. So if you're listening, check that one out.
Can you just post that on our website, or how does that work?
People are going to have to go have a look at our Flickr site.
Okay.
I'm sure I could do it. I'm not going to.
Awesome.
There's some sort of
way to make that.
Well, see, all rights reserved.
That extra. Yeah. See? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't make the rules here.
I'm sure Derek could just send it to you.
Yeah.
Making him famous.
Like I said, we'll send him a link. We'll send a link. People can click on the Flickr site. And we had one come in today.
You didn't even describe what the photo is, though.
Go look at it.
Okay.
It's awesome.
You got to look for Derek. What's his last name again?
I wrote it down.
Beelzebub?
Yeah.
Something like that?
That's great. Make it weird. Another one comes in from Halifax. You ever been to Halifax?
I was born in Nova Scotia.
Were you really?
Yeah.
You know that Nova Scotia means New Scotia? Did you know that?
No, I don't know. I don't know what it means.
Well, okay. anyway, so Iguana Sign. His name's Glenn, but it looks like his Flickr name is Iguana Sign. Posted one that I thought really caught my eye.
Graffiti. You love the graffiti.
I don't. Yeah, I don't. Do I?
Yeah, you do.
I'm sick of graffiti.
But you take pictures where there's graffiti.
Because it's Germany. Everything is graffiti.
Okay.
They love graffiti in Germany. I don't get it.
I like well-done graffiti.
Yes.
Not in my living room, but...
Yeah. Once again, I apologize.
Yeah.
I had a little too much to drink at that party.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, so this one's... I like the... it's like a real fish-out-of-water kind of thing. Because you do not expect a leaf to be here in this urban setting.
Yeah, it looks like it might have been placed.
It looks like it's glued on something. Like, is that railroad tracks?
I don't know.
That's what it is. In my head, those are railroad tracks. And it's on the side. But regardless, we got a nice shadow coming in. And
yeah.
So, mostly I'm impressed with the fact that you do not expect to see a leaf in this setting. So, good work, Iguana-san. Did I pronounce that right?
Yeah.
All right. Moving on. What's our next, week's topic?
I don't know. What is it?
We hadn't talked about it yet. Digital photo myths.
Sounds excellent.
Yeah. So there's a lot of myths running around about, well, can you think of any yourself without looking at the outline?
No.
Well, what are some things that for instance... Here's my favorite myth. Do you need a UV filter?
I don't have one, so I'm going to say no.
When you bought, I don't know the answer.
Well, you said need. You might want. There's a difference between wants possibly. And needs.
Yes, but when you go to the store, oftentimes the guy working there, the clerk, tells you you need one, tries to sell you a UV filter.
Yeah. They also tell you you need to buy insurance.
Yes. Good point. There's another myth.
Yeah.
What about sharpening? Do you ever do sharpening?
Like of knives?
Post-production sharpening?
A little bit.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Do I need to?
We're going to find out. I'm not going to spoil, spoiler alert, but I sat down with Chris Marquardt. And he's going to answer all... But hang on a second. He's going to answer all those questions for us.
Okay, so you're just setting it up. We're setting the table here.
We're teeing this up. we're talking about a crop... what the difference between full frame and crop sensor.
Didn't you write a whole blog on that?
I wrote a series about the difference between crop sensors and the full frame.
And where can those be found?
That's at AlNetridge. No, I don't know.
See how I did that?
Yeah, I just have an answer. Something WordPress.
Yeah.
WordPress.com. Is that me? I'm not sure. No, you can find it if you go to our website, twohosers.com. You can click on the podcast, on the blog
link. I wish I never said anything.
Yeah. Edit all this out now. Now here's the one myth that you and I can talk about quick, because Chris does answer the question.
Okay.
Can you trust your LCD screen?
No.
Well, that's what you think. What do you mean? What can't you trust?
Can't trust the focus.
Can't trust the focus. What happened yesterday at previously mentioned barbecue?
I took a group shot of the whole gang and with your 30mm lens. And I looked at the picture. I think I shot a series of five pictures. And then I checked it after the fact.
Setting the scene, people were... someone had pulled the fire alarm at our party. And everyone was
leaving at once. Yeah. So we quickly set up a picture. Yeah. And I got everyone in position. Oh, that's the coffee saying it's done. But okay. So I quickly set everything up and had some off-camera flash. Took the picture. Everyone was looking. I was super thrilled that we got it off in the time frame we had to work with. And then I checked the LCD, and I was convinced from looking at the LCD that it was out of focus. And then you assured me, don't worry, stop being a baby, go home and look at it on your computer, and in all likelihood, it's going to be fine. And it was. So
you can't. I found that you can't trust it for focus. Can you trust it for exposure?
The point of that story was that you called me a baby, though.
Well, I think you called yourself a baby. That made no sense. Let me think of a better comeback there. Yeah, so the LCD screen, I mean, everyone does the chimping, like they like to call it, and the LCD screen isn't good for it that much stuff. I mean, it is good. It's useful, but can you trust it? Well, Chris will tell us. So without further ado... We're going to go to I sat down when do you think it was? A week ago?
Yeah, and you did a brief interview, right?
Oh, no. This is going to buckle your seatbelts. This is the first hour of a 12-hour interview.
Get your helmets on, too.
Oh, God.
In case you pass out.
Yeah. No. It's under an hour.
Okay.
I sat down with Chris Marquardt, who you might know from Tips from the Top Floor.
Which is a fantastic podcast.
Unlike this dog and pony show we're putting on. I recommend listening to him first, and then, you know, if you have time.
get around to our podcast.
Get around to it. Chris was nice enough to sit down with me. So Chris is the host of the longest-running photo podcast in the world called Tips from the Top Floor. He leads workshops around the world, including in the Himalayas.
Sure.
Or Himalaya, depends how you say it.
Yeah.
Caribbean, I don't know.
Yeah.
Those are two different places. Washington, D.C., New York, San Francisco, Toronto, Berlin, just to name a few. And he's a regular on Leo Laporte's show, The Tech Guy.
Okay.
So without further ado, here is Chris and I. And we're back with Chris Marquardt back on the top floor.
Yay!
The host of Tips from the Top Floor. And I've worked with Chris a few times, and I got to tell you, you're difficult to work with.
I am.
It's your name. It's nothing to do with you. You're great to work with, but your last name is tough. You don't have the last, like, you know the last names that you can just shout out, like, oh, man, did you hear about Schwartz? Oh, yeah, he had too many beers and threw up on himself.
Now you're picking on German names. Is that it?
It's just your name.
Not even a German name. Actually, it is a German. It's actually a very Germanic name. I just recently found out that it has a meaning. Marquardt has a meaning. It is the protector of the forest.
Well, Star Wars?
No, it's
a Star Wars thing.
It goes back, way back.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. No, and it has the QU and the DT in it because about 100 years ago, people here in Germany thought it was chic to be French, so they added those the kind of French style to it, and people sometimes pronounce it Marquardt, and it's Marquardt,
and you're in the French Quarter.
I'm here in Tübingen in the French Quarter.
There you go.
So it's a perfect fit.
It's difficult to call out, like, hey, did you hear about Marquardt? It doesn't make sense. You hear about Attridge?
Say Chris, it's okay.
Yeah, okay. Everybody's named Chris.
Yeah, I know.
So
I'm actually named Christoph.
I did not. Okay, there you go.
We'll
say that then.
Well, the problem is most North Americans get Christoph wrong because they make it into Christopher.
Right.
Because that's the normal way to say it. That's the normal style of the name.
Christoph Waltz fixed that now. Everyone knows, I think.
He did, but I just decided when I started doing the podcast that it's got to be Chris. It's got to be simple, easy. No complicated. I don't want to explain how to
pronounce it. In reality, you're good to work with. It's just the name. I'm just saying.
It's just a weird name.
Yeah, I think it's something
solid. Alan with two L's, huh?
Oh, hey, Attridge. Alan with two L's.
And Attridge. Come on.
Hey, Attridge. So you can say that. You can make fun of that guy. Marquardt's hard to make fun of that guy.
Yeah. Make fun of me as much as you like. I don't
care. this interview, this show is going to be about photo myths, digital photography myths.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of them.
There's a lot of mythology surrounding digital photography. Mm. So let's start knocking them off.
Cool. Let's go.
Do you have a list? Do you have any? I was just joking. I made a list.
Analog is more awesome than digital.
Well, that's obvious. Clearly. Sharpening. Here's this to me is the biggest one. This is the one I fell for recently, is sharpening.
I fell for it a long time. The thing about sharpening is that people tell you, and you read it everywhere, it's like sharpening's got to be the last step in the chain of modifying and working on pictures, of editing. And that kind of implies that you have to do sharpening at the end.
I agree that it is the last step.
It should be the last step.
If it's a step.
If you look into it, if it is a step, only if it is a step. And there are just very few cases that really warrant the sharpening. Sharpening is not even... I mean, sharpening doesn't make the picture sharper. It makes it appear sharper. That's the biggest thing. It adds contrasts at boundaries, at the black and white, dark and bright things in the picture. It makes the dark side darker, the bright side brighter. That's how it adds contrast, which makes the eye perceive it as being sharper. And the result is that, well, that you go, oh, that's punchy. But then you print it out, and that should be the final measure. If you print the picture out, there's a whole lot of stuff going on inside the printer driver, and the printer itself does stuff, and then you have a picture that, I don't know, looks digital. I think... The early digital cameras suffered from that a lot.
Right.
Like the really early point-and-shoots, 2-megapixel kind of things.
Now, is the Bayer interpolation less with more megapixels? Is the effect less?
The Bayer interpolation? Well, the Bayer interpolation adds a bit of blurriness.
Mm-hmm.
So does the anti-aliasing filter, which is a piece of glass in front of the lens that basically makes the picture slightly blurry. In order to avoid stair-stepping of diagonals and these kind of things that can happen with a Bayer pattern.
But in theory, and I'm just putting this out there, if we have 21 megapixels on a space that used to have 4 megapixels...
Oh, those effects will be finer and smaller, and because if you resolve that diagonal with more pixels, it'll look smoother, obviously.
So I used to sharpen a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then you told me, word for word, you said... Sharpening is overrated.
It is.
And that's all it took. And I took one step back and I started comparing some of my digital shots with some of my film shots that I've taken in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I am way over sharpening.
Mm-hmm.
Why does it need to be that sharp?
And sometimes you don't even have to sharpen an entire picture. Sometimes it's okay in a portrait to just sharpen the eyes a bit and maybe the lips and just those... areas, the earrings, or the rim of a glass of glasses, just some detail that will help the picture kind of jump at you. Sharpening is overrated. There are just a few areas where I sharpen, and the most prominent is if I put something on the web somewhere, and I know that the browser's not going to resize it. I know that, for example, like in as a part of a website design, a picture in a header or something, that I want that to be crisp. And I know the browser's not going to do any resizing because that kind of throws the whole thing out of the window anyway. If I know the exact pixel sizes of that thing and I know it's going to be that size, then I will do some sharpening to make it crisp and nice to look at. But as soon as... if you upload something on Flickr, you know what Flickr does? It takes your picture, it calculates different resolutions, a thumbnail, a small, a medium, a large, an original, whatever. So it has those 4 or 5 levels of pictures depending on how you look at them. And those do not just get resized, they get sharpened. So Flickr adds its own level of sharpening on top. Yes.
I also find that when I if I sharpen too much, my gray hair becomes really gray.
Yeah, and you know why? Because it adds those halos. It makes those bright areas brighter, so the gray hair comes out brighter. So
I go the other way. I just darken it all in.
You color the hair.
I
digitally coloring.
Always dodging, and so many pictures of me now. It's a full time job, dodging and burning my hair.
Well, saturation. Just accept it. You're getting older.
Roll with it. That's true. Saturation. That's my other one. Uh-huh. Is that I see so much of, and I kind of got caught up early on in the digital process.
Mm-hmm.
Of oversaturating even my film scans.
Mm. Well, to judge saturation, you first of all need to have a good, well-profiled monitor. If you don't know if the monitor is lying to you, you can play with saturation as much as you want. It might be totally off. So as soon as you have that established, I think it becomes a style choice. It becomes a creative choice. I have pictures where I crank the saturation, where I go for lots of saturation.
What's crank?
Well, to increase the saturation.
Yeah, no, but how much would you say is crank? Like, you don't go to 2 point.
I don't put a number at that. It's a visual. I decide while I move that slider. I don't go, I go to plus 11% and that's it. Some shots work good. Some shots don't work good with that. But only shots that I kind of think deserve it. Sometimes I go as detailed as changing saturation just for one color. I know I want that green to pop way more without doing anything to the yellow or the red. Now, luckily, today's tools, such as Lightroom, for example, allow us to do that, to selectively change things. With a lot of shots, less saturation helps to take the color hierarchy out of the picture. You know how you have a black and white? Okay, let's start with black and white. I shoot a lot of black and white lately because it reduces that picture. It takes a whole hierarchy of attention out of the picture. With black and white, you have shapes, you have lines, you have black and white, you have dark and bright, you have contrasts. All those things guide the eye. All those things help the viewer, or all those things can help you tell a story. And as soon as you add color, you have two competing hierarchies. The color hierarchy, there might be this dark area in a picture that was not very interesting in a black and white picture, and you wanted it not to be interesting because you wanted to keep the attention on a different part of the picture, and all of a sudden you add something red, a warm warning type of color into that dark area, and all of a sudden that becomes way more interesting than you actually want it to be. So sometimes desaturating a picture can help to take care of that. And sometimes it's just a stylistic choice. It's just a choice that I like it better this or that way.
So do I need to shoot on Vivid preset or not?
Well, shooting on Vivid preset, which is an Nikon term. I'm not sure what the Canon equivalent is, but Vivid cranks the saturation. That is only valid if you shoot JPEG anyway. If you shoot RAW, that doesn't matter. We can set it as much as you want. It will matter on the preview, on your display of the camera, because that shows you a JPEG. That's a long story.
That's a very long story. Well, talk about your LCD screen.
Uh-huh.
Can you trust it?
Totally not.
Yeah, me neither. This is where I always end up breaking down.
Well, the thing is, you and I both happen to use the same camera, the 5D Mark II by Canon. And that has a very good screen. The screen is very good. Actually, one of the best screens I've ever had on a DSLR. It's got good resolution. It's got good color representation, but it still is a moving target, because what happens is that, okay, what are the things you can judge on a display? You can judge composition, where you place things in the shot.
Right.
If that one branch of that tree is pointing in on the left top where you didn't want it to point, that kind of stuff, you can judge that. But as soon as you get into brightness, how often has it happened that you came home with a picture that looked awesome on the display and then you put it in the computer and went poof?
Oh, never. I'm actually very good at taking pictures. Yes. But no, all the time.
That is a normal thing. And lots of people will go, yes, happens all the time. So when you take those pictures...
And when it was 2 inches large, it looked in focus.
Oh yeah, the focus. But judging focus is a totally different thing. You can even zoom in all the way into that picture, and you won't be able to assess the focus fully because you're zooming into a small JPEG. Because even if you shoot in RAW, the camera is gonna convert it into a JPEG and use that as a preview. So even that is, even there, you're not looking at the actual resolution.
So what do you use the LCD?
But that aside, the judging brightness on the LCD. It's futile because first of all, you take this camera into different light conditions. You look at it in the sun, you look at it in the shade, you look at it in whatever conditions, and your eyes are not a scientific instrument. So they are always influenced by what's going on around that display, and you're always going to have something different around that display. So if you have a very bright thing around that display, the display will look darker to you. If you have something dark around the display will look brighter to you. Now, Canon has built in that nice feature, I'm doing air quotes here, where you can set the display to auto brightness. It has a little sensor built in. So then it turns into an even worse moving target because you end up with this thing going bright and dark. So judging the brightness of a picture on the display, difficult or impossible. Most other cameras are even worse. Judging colors, difficult because you are looking at a JPEG and that has been created from that raw picture, and that has been created according to, now we come back to the vivid setting. If you set your camera to vivid, that JPEG has been created according to that vivid setting. Has nothing to do with the raw
file. Mind, but that also affects your exposure.
And that affects exposure, and then the only thing that you can kind of trust when you look at the display is the histogram. The histogram should give you like a numeric representation or a graphical representation of how many bright pixels are in the picture, how many dark pixels are in the picture, how many medium pixels are in the picture. So you get a brightness distribution. But that histogram is, again, based on the JPEG.
Right.
So if you have a very contrasty JPEG, if you have a very contrasty vivid setting, for example, that histogram will not be quite as neutral as you want it to
be. Do you generally know what, if you take a picture, before you look at the histogram, do you know what to expect or what you're hoping to expect?
Well, I know when I look at a scene and, for example, it has a big white wall in it, I know that the histogram will probably lean towards the right because it has to have a lot of bright in it. That's the wall. If I know, let the camera do it, do the exposure, the camera will probably try to pull that more towards the middle, so the white wall will likely be gray. But I know that, and I exposure compensate. I tell the camera, nah, 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 you can't do that. You have to. I kind of nudge the camera into the right direction. And so I know what histogram to expect from the scene. I typically check that histogram. If it's really important that I expose the scene well, I look at the histogram. And if it's not where I want it to be, if it's not as I expected it to be, I know I got it wrong and I'll have to take a second shot. I have to correct and take a second shot.
So you use the LCD screen essentially just for the...
Mostly for the histogram. Mostly to see if I got the exposure the way I wanted it to be, the way I envisioned it to be. Usually have a bit of an idea about the picture before I press the shutter.
Right. Overexposed versus underexposed. Now, this one, back in the film days, everything comes back to the film days. It's where everybody started.
Mm-hmm.
It's the reason you can take digital photos now. Back in the film days, we were always taught, and I always overexposed by usually like 2/3 of a stop. That was my benchmark. That's the baseline. Now, that's a habit I had to kind of get out of when I started shooting digital. Because I would kind of overexpose a lot. So overexpose or underexpose for the best results.
Okay. So when we look at the analog side, the slight overexposure helped you to get more detail in the shadows. Because once you lost the shadows in analog, they're kind of lost. There was not much going on down there. And then you have to see that analog is a two-step process. You create a negative, you develop that, and then you make an enlargement, which gives you that second step where you still have lots of ways to correct things and get them right. With digital, we kind of have that two-step process by doing post-processing, putting it in Aperture and Lightroom. But in fact, what's in the shot, what's in the raw file, the information that's there, that's what you've got. Now, there are philosophies nowadays, and I have to say the dark areas, the shadow areas of a digital picture have a lot more detail than the shadow areas of a film picture. So in general, you can... It's easier to underexpose. You can still kind of salvage some information there, even though you typically add some noise in return. But one of the philosophies that has come out of that is the exposed to right to the right philosophy, where and you read that a lot, that you should expose as high as possible without overexposure,
right?
And then turn it back down into the range that the picture was supposed to be. And the reason is, well, first of all, the apparent reason is that up in the, okay, when you, oh, this is difficult to explain. If you look at the digital representation of a picture, the higher levels, the brighter levels, there are more bits up there to encode information. So the brighter levels mean that you, apparently mean that you, if you expose up there, you have more information, and then if you pull it down, you distribute that more information over a wider range. It's super geeky. So yeah. I hope people are gonna turn off. But the thing is, that assumes that you work in a linear system, that the entire exposure range of a digital camera is fully linear, which it is not anymore today. It used to be, and then you had these harsh cutoffs in the bright areas where the overexposure would look very bad because you'd have hard edges where the light gray became white. And nowadays, the digital cameras basically mimic what film cameras do. They have a soft curve, a soft compression curve in the highlights and in the shadows. And so when you expose to the right, when you expose as high as possible, you expose in that nonlinear range, in the probably the last stop to two stops before it overexposes. That's where this curve happens. Depends on camera and settings and stuff.
So if you bring a RAW file into, say, Aperture or Lightroom, you can use the sliders to recover highlights or bring up the shadows.
Yes.
Which would you rather do?
Well,
would you rather save a picture that you underexposed by bringing the shadows up, or would you rather try to bring back some blown highlights? Faster.
I typically expose where it needs to be. So I try to nail the exposure. I don't try to expose in one direction or the other. I try to get the exposure the way I want it for that picture. If I miss, dialing in more shadow detail is easy, but to a certain point, it doesn't look good. From a certain point, it doesn't look good. So you can only go so far. But the same is true with the highlights. You can only go so far until it looks funny. Actually, I heard from an Adobe guy that Lightroom, when you use the recovery slider to get more, let's say you have a blown out sky or blown out clouds and you want to get those back, to a certain point that Lightroom takes that information from the RAW file. If the RAW file is at its end, if there's no more information, Lightroom starts making things up.
Really?
Yes. So you end up with a, yeah, and sometimes it looks crap.
Right.
Right? And that's because Lightroom doesn't know. So it's okay, the slider hasn't ended yet, but the information has ended. What do I do? So you keep pulling the slider, and at one point, Lightroom has to start making things up, and that's what it does. It tries to guess, but it sometimes is not very good at
that. When I bring the highlights back, I find I can't quite get the colors to look how I wanted them to look.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difficult part I find. So I would prefer, I eat the noise. I prefer to bring the shadows up if I have to, and deal with the noise versus the bad color.
But the reason for that is, first of all, that it's in a very nonlinear area up there. It's not linear. Again, that's a myth. And the other thing is that Lightroom or Aperture or whatever, they make things up. And then you can't get the colors right because it kind of takes them out of thin air.
Okay, next myth. You can't have any blown highlights in a picture and have the picture still be
totally
good.
Totally not. No. No, never. Never blow out highlights. That's
never,
forbidden.
Never?
It's forbidden.
Uh-oh. Okay, well.
No.
I blow out highlights.
Me too. Well, the simple fact is the camera has a certain dynamic range that it can cover. And if you have a scene that is has a bigger dynamic range, has darker darks and brighter brights than the camera can capture, you will either lose some bottom or some top. You will lose some of that. And if you can fill in the shadows with some more light, be it a flash or a reflector or something, or if you can't darken down the brights, the highlights in some way, then you lose it. It's very simple. So in the end, I typically try to expose well for my subject, for the thing that the picture is about. And if that means losing some highlights, blowing something out, then so be it.
That was our motto when we started shooting digital video. Expose for the face.
That's what, in most pictures that have people in them, that might be an interesting or important part in the picture. Expose for the face. And that, Or it's a creative decision. I mean, I do have pictures that I completely blew out parts of because that helped me tell the story.
There's other pictures I have on my wall that I didn't blow them out on purpose. I would like for them to have been in the range, mm-hmm. but they weren't. And so 95% of the picture is how I want it. Mm-hmm. And, well, if the rest is blown out, it's blown out. Mm-hmm. That's how it was on that day.
Yeah, and one thing I typically don't do then is start to with multiple exposures and HDR things and so on. That's just in very rare circumstances that I have to use that. I typically don't want to use that.
Me neither. Not to rip on it. I get it. I understand why the kids wear the baggy pants nowadays. I'm not doing it.
Yeah. It's a stylistic choice. If you like it, so be it. But no.
Can somebody be self-taught nowadays?
What do you mean?
This is a hot button issue.
Of course.
Because oftentimes, you know, people have asked me, hey, how did you learn how to take flash pictures? And my instinct is to say, well, I was self-taught because I didn't go to school for that, except for I read all of strobus.com. Mm. And so I think David Hobby, who I've never met, hopefully will someday, I think he would take issue with the fact that I claim to be self-taught.
I think everybody's self-taught.
Oh, you're a glasses half full kind of guy.
No, everyone is self-taught. If you believe that that by listening to podcasts or by reading books that you will actually learn something, you might get some instructions, you might get some tips, you might get some techniques, some stuff that will help you. That will help you learn. Even people on the workshops. I mean, if you have a driver's license, does that mean you are a good driver? No, it means you are allowed to go on the road and practice driving. That's what it means. And the same is true with a podcast or a book or a workshop. At the end, you won't be an accomplished photographer. That takes years. And that takes tens of thousands of pictures. That takes practice. And the practice is the only way to get it. So you are self-taught. You teach yourself and by doing it. That's the only way to learn. That's my definition of being self-taught. Everyone is self-taught. And it doesn't really matter where you get that information from. You might get a bit more structured information from a photography school. You might get a bit more unstructured, chaotic information from the web. You might get a lot of false information from the web. You might also get some false information at a school. So in the end, everyone has to be grown up enough to filter what's good for them, what they need, and then go out and do it. And this way you learn.
Well, I hadn't thought of it that way.
Hmm.
I guess no one forces you to go to school.
No.
So you, in that regard, you are self-taught.
Everyone's self-taught.
So that's not a myth. People can be self-taught.
But if it's a very it is a hot button issue because it's very controversial. I mean, obviously someone else will will provide you with the information and will hopefully create situations for you that you can learn in. But you have to do the learning yourself. No one's going to do that for you. It's work and it's hard work.
You can lead a horse to water.
Yes,
but you can't make him wear a bathing suit.
Awesome.
That's Woodwork. Woodwork, grade 8, Woodwork, Don Bricich. That's for you, buddy, my teacher. Well, okay. Now, the other myth is that this one's kind of been beaten up a lot. You have to have an expensive camera.
Yes.
That's true?
Totally.
Okay.
No, actually, Nikon stepped into that recently. They did a Facebook post. I don't have it here, but it basically said that in order to take good pictures, you need a good camera and great lenses, and probably some marketing guy going a bit overboard, and that got them a lot of backlash. You should have seen the uproar, because that's a slap in the face of photographers. Of course, you don't need a good camera to take a good picture. To tell a story, you need a camera. To tell a story with a photograph, you need a camera, and that is it. Now, use the tool that that's good for the job to help you tell that story. That's what it's about.
I agree. The entry-level cameras, the worst cameras that they make nowadays, are so good.
Oh, just a short while ago, I saw this blog entry somewhere. This photographer went out to shoot a building that was about to be torn down, and he brought his 8x10 large format camera, huge bellows camera with a cloth over the head. He brought his SLR, film SLR, DSLR, medium format gear, and a Holga plastic camera, mm-hmm, with a plastic lens. And he shot this building with all those different cameras, and he did the best he could. And that old derelict building hasn't been used in many years and kind of half broken down. And he showed all these pictures, and he ended up concluding that the Holga picture was by far the best one because it conveyed the right mood, and but the unsharpness and the vignetting in the lens gave the picture this very special mood. And it was not one of those hipster things. It was just that was the best fit for the job. So in this case, yep, you have to have a good camera, the camera that is good for the job. So if that's the definition, absolutely, you have to have a good camera, the one that helps you tell the story. Totally.
I should have said expensive camera. No, I did say expensive camera.
But you didn't. You wrote it, but you didn't say it.
I said I'm going to roll that back. I said expensive. You need an expensive camera.
Yeah, no.
See, I find the cameras now to be so cheap, mm-hmm, too. That's the thing. I don't know if that's perspective or not, because some people still don't think that. Some people think, okay, well, $500, that's a lot of money, which it is. But when I think about what you're getting for your $500 from entry-level camera now.
Oh, those cameras are awesome. You can take a lot of great pictures with even most entry-level cameras.
But the best part is that you can take a lot of bad pictures with them. That's what I like.
And you can take a lot of bad pictures with a Canon 1D Mark something.
Yes, you can.
Those or a Nikon D... What do I know what's the current camera?
Yes, but if you take a bad picture with the entry-level camera, you don't feel as guilty.
Or you don't feel as stupid.
Stupid? I don't like to call people stupid, but maybe you feel bad for taking bad pictures.
Well,
but
happened to me. I'm speaking out of my own experience, because I had a Nikon D3 for a month on loan to test it out with some good glass. And that was one of those eureka moments, like, wow, I got awesome gear here. And then I went out shooting and I looked at the pictures, and they were not a single bit better than my other pictures that I took with my, back then, what was it, Canon 20D? They were sharper.
Mm-hmm.
I could expose in lower light. They were technically better, but the pictures themselves didn't move me in any other way than any of my other pictures. So that's an experience everyone should have one day. And don't mix up a sharper picture with a better picture. Those are two different things.
You must have a UV filter.
No.
You go to the store. I mean, you go to the store nowadays. I don't know how it works in Germany.
Yeah. That's one of my pet peeves, actually. Yeah. Obviously, you go into the store, and it's the easiest sell a camera salesman can do. And they have a super wide margin on these filters.
I understand that on the cameras, not such a wide margin.
The cameras, really no. They make their money on bags, on tripods, on filters, on
extended
all this
warranty.
Kind of extended warranty is a very favorite one.
Oh, I should have wrote that one down.
On memory cards, on all the accessories, straps, all the other accessories, gear, accessory stuff, lens hoods. Some cheaper lenses don't come with lens hoods.
Yep. And in Canada, that's extra. There's a huge margin on those.
Yeah. So,
well, I don't know if there's a huge margin, but they're expensive.
Yeah, but the thing is that the filter because, oh yeah, you have this new shiny camera, you want to protect it, right?
Yeah.
So you get, they sell you on this, let's say you have a $500 lens on that, they sell you a $20 filter, and
now you're shooting with a $20 lens.
Now you're shooting with a $20 lens, because all the pictures, all the light that makes those pictures has to go through that crappy filter. And it's crappy because it's cheap and it has bad coating, and that means there is an additional few reflective surfaces there that will bounce light back and forth, and it'll take away contrast, and it'll give you ghost lights. Like I received this email from a listener of my show to the Christmas tree picture with like twice the amount of lights on the tree because the filter in conjunction with the front element created ghost images. But the thing is, if you want that filter to be of like to be optically as unobtrusive as possible, you will have to buy an expensive filter, and then we're talking maybe $100
minimum.
So guess what? A scratch in the front element will, in most cases, never show up on the picture.
Right.
I shot some of my best pictures with a telephoto lens with a massive scratch in the front, and it didn't show up on the pictures. And if that's a real concern to you, you can send that lens in for repair, and they will replace that front element. Guess how much that is?
No clue. $200?
$200.
Yeah. That to me is worth the gamble.
So you have either you have like $150 piece of glass in front of the camera that will make pictures worse in one way or another, because it doesn't belong in that light path, that's $150. Or you take the gamble. And by the way, my lens hood has protected my lens so many times from scratches, from dings. Lens hood is a very good accessory because it's not in the way. It keeps out stray light from the sides. It helps the contrast in your picture. You don't need the filter. And if you get the scratch on there, and if it really bothers you, then get it fixed. And
I've seen people. Okay, what is bigger fingernails on a chalkboard for you? Seeing people with a UV filter on the $100 kit lens, or people with the lens hood on backwards. each of them drives me nuts.
Both of them drive me nuts. I don't know which is bigger. There are filters that make sense, and there are some circumstances where filters make sense. Some very expensive lenses are water sealed, but only if you use a filter. Mm-hmm. In some areas, some people might be more happy with a filter, for example, in the desert when you have fine sand in the air, and that might creep into the mechanisms.
That's going to beat up your 550 anyway, or whatever this camera.
Well, you know, and even then, I had a lens that I used back with my X700, my good old analog Minolta, and that I took that to the beach one day, and then it got sand in there, and the focusing went slightly crunchy for a while, and then after a few crunches, the crunches went away, and it stopped doing that, and I never had it cleaned or anything, and it kept chugging along for another 4 or 5 years until I replaced it with something else. But it wasn't really damaged by that.
So no UV filter.
I don't use them.
I don't use them either.
I don't use them.
Don't do it. Next myth, crop sensors, no good.
Good question. What for? I mean, the one thing that the crop sensor will do is it will change. Well, it's called a crop sensor for a reason. It crops out part of, if you put the same lens on the camera, on a non-crop or on a crop camera, the crop camera will, the lens will still shine the same image circle into the camera, but the sensor will be smaller, so you will crop out part of that. You will basically, it will act as if it was a longer focal length. So the 100 millimeters will turn into a 160, for example.
Sort of,
yeah. It doesn't change the focal length of the lens.
I did a 5-part series on my blog.
Yeah,
about that.
It's very, very, you can spend a lot of time explaining that. But the thing is, the crop sensor is just a different size sensor, and therefore will give you different things. It will give you a different depth of field. It will use parts of the image circle, a smaller part of the image circle, which is actually the better part of the image circle, because towards the edges, that image circle will get worse. The quality of the picture will get worse. You see that especially in cheaper lenses or in some wide-angle lenses. I come from the crop sensor. I come from the SLR, from the film SLR, which is full frame, 35 millimeters. And then my first digital SLR was a crop sensor, and that I grew up on full frame. So it was difficult for me because all of a sudden the 24 millimeter lens is not a 24 millimeter anymore.
Right. Dealing in the equivalence. I always thinking
but
about...
The thing is, I used those lenses and the image quality was very good. And then as soon as I had a full-frame camera, I put those lenses on a full-frame. And then I saw how much vignetting there was in this lens and how bad the quality went towards the edges. So a crop sensor has its advantages, absolutely.
I found that there is a difference in the depth of field, but it's actually you really have to look for it.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point that it's not worth writing home about, I found.
Yeah.
If that's the only reason you're buying it, then don't buy it.
Yeah, I've tried all sorts of formats. From a fraction of an inch, like a little mobile phone. I've taken some awesome pictures with an iPhone 4, which has a small sensor, at different depth of field. Now I shoot with 5x4 inches large format film cameras, which have a very different depth of field, and all of them have their individual. Yeah, what do you call it? Expression. And it's different for different cameras with different size sensors. And sometimes the smaller sizes work better. Sometimes the larger sizes work better for... And it's, again, a matter of what kind of a story you want to tell or how you want to tell it. It's a tool. It's a part of the creative toolbox. And if you have that one camera with that one sensor, make the best of it. And be happy. Yeah. Go shoot.
I still shoot with my 40D often, but I like my 5D better, of course. Yeah. But that's not no surprise. But the crop sensor cameras are still really good. That's my myth busting.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, last question. All print shops, like photo. What do you call them? Like where you get your photos processed, printed.
Drugstores.
Not drugstores. Yeah, in a pinch.
Well, in a pinch, they
in
have
a pinch.
Most of, yeah.
Photomat. What do we call them now?
I don't know.
But you guys, you understand what I'm talking about. They're all created equal. True or false? Because I can go to the drugstore and get I can get a print for 7 cents.
Well, the
other place wants 50 cents.
Yeah.
Why?
Sure. Okay. So there's the big labs, and I can only speak for Germany. We have I think less than four, maybe two or three big labs in Germany that do all the drugstore processing. So if you, I'd say probably those five, go to the five most popular drugstore chains and they probably all have their pictures developed in the same big lab. And so in this way, yeah, they're sort of created equal. And then there are the smaller shops, ones that have emerged from a more pro-focused market that want better quality, where you get print profiles and where you can send in TIFF files instead of JPEGs and where you can, whatever, deliver a different format and get maybe even a proof. But that's a totally different animal. So in general, the cheap drugstore kind of pictures, they are okay. I wouldn't expect too much of them.
That's how it works in Canada as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is you can go to somewhere like London Drugs. Mm-hmm. Where you're going to pay probably 50 cents for a 4x6
mm-hmm.
or 10x15 in centimeters. Or you can get it done at your sort of your bulk place like Costco or something like that mm-hmm. for 19 cents.
Well,
so the breakdown for me is I always go for the 50 cents.
Yeah.
Because they do a phenomenally better job.
Well, and it's a bit hit or miss. So what my brother and I did at one time is we actually took the same set of pictures and each of us had them developed at 10 different labs or 10 different stores or 10 different online services where you upload the pictures. And we, on all of them, we unchecked the box that says, optimize my pictures.
Right.
Where they will then do some, I don't know, auto processing on it. So in order to kind of take that that variable out of it, and we ended up with 10 or with 20 different results. None of them were the same. They were all different in terms of the color, in terms of contrast. Some were better, some were worse.
How did it look compared to your LCD screen?
Don't even try to compare a lit screen with a reflective paper. That's the two different animals. But the thing is, then that was the first hit and miss experience. Then I chose a few of them that I liked and did a similar test half a year later, and I still got different results back. It has to do with how often they calibrate their machines and how often they... I don't know. The thing is, if you find a provider that you like, stick with it. That's probably my takeaway from that.
Okay.
Or maybe get into printing them yourself. It's a pretty interesting journey. You can learn a lot about printing. It's a bit more expensive. When I print my own pictures, like 4x6, they are probably more in the 30-cent range, but I get what I want, and I get it right now. So I do my own prints mostly.
So I'm going to pay you to make my prints then.
I'm not offering that as a service unless we can negotiate a pretty high rate per print.
That would be fine. I do not like doing my own prints. I think whoever invented printers, they always
was evil.
They're so evil. I thought they're supposed to...
I like it.
By 2011, they're supposed to talk to each other now. Printers and computers.
I like printing, but it was a journey to get to that point. It was a learning curve to get to that point. But now I kind of know how to approach printers, and I speak the language.
If I want to print a black and white document, and my printer is out of red ink, why won't it print? That's what I'm saying. That's the problem with printing.
Mine does.
Yeah, yours does. I got to go buy red ink to print a black and white document. Sounds like a bit of a scam to me.
Well, you, I can show you how to set it to grayscale.
I've set it to grayscale. Okay, that's too much of a tangent. That's the end of the interview. I'm cutting it off here.
Yep.
That sounded a lot more aggressive. Really, Chris is out of time. He's a busy guy. So thanks for taking the time.
I thank you for coming here. Awesome.
And welcome back here with the two hosers.
That was good stuff.
You listened to all of it?
Most of it.
Did you hear the part where he talked about you?
No. What did he say about me?
I cut that part out eventually. one thing I forgot to ask him, and I wish I had. I'm going to ask him in email. Do you put a protective guard on your LCD screen?
I don't.
I almost
bought one, though.
Tell me why.
Because it looked cool and the packaging was shiny.
When I first got my camera, my first digital SLR, my 40D a few years ago, I was worried crazy about the LCD screen. What if I get a scratch? What if I get a scratch? What if I get a scratch? What's going to happen?
Is it going to fall off?
No. It's not going to affect my pictures one bit. It's not like I'm displaying them to the public on my LCD screen.
And they're not cheap, those LCD protectors. I think it's $20, the one I was looking at.
I think the Nikon comes with them.
Oh, okay.
And then the Canon ones you have to buy. And I cannot imagine, if anybody tells you you need one, they're not being truthful.
Okay.
I think that's a myth, that you need that. So, because we talked about UV filters with Chris and lens hoods and how to protect your camera. I should have asked that. So I'll find out what he has to say about that. So for next week's challenge.
Well, I don't have one. So.
I got something for you.
Oh, great!
It's a leaf picture.
Yes, of a Toronto maple leaf.
Toronto maple leaf. It's not a leaf picture at all. I've noticed not just you, but a lot of people. To a lot of people, the word portrait. If I say, "Hey, make a portrait." The instinct is to get in close.
Yes.
And that's mine as well. It's get in, show the face. That's what you want to do.
Yes.
So in the effort to go against that, we're going to shoot a wide portrait.
Okay.
Which essentially, I don't know if that's the best terminology.
I don't know what that
it.
Means. Is that a person with just more background?
Yes. It's essentially going to be a person.
Yes.
With more background.
Okay.
No, in context, first of all.
Yeah.
So we're going to establish a context of where they're in, because that's part of it. It's oftentimes you see the close-up. You don't have no idea where they are. So it's going to be a portrait of somebody in context, but it should include a wide angle. Doesn't have to be shot with a wide angle lens.
Right. You just have to back up.
You just have to back up, or they could back up.
You both could back up.
You both back up. Yeah, so the person should not dominate the frame.
But they should be the focal point.
They should be the focal point.
Okay.
So how do you take a portrait of somebody in context? That's all it is.
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, well, until then, where can people find your stuff? Where can people find the barbecue pics?
They can find them on schwartzchronicles.com. And even more importantly, the pictures of my kids at the park with my... What did you call them? The remote, the voice-activated light stands? Yeah.
The voice-activated
light stands. SchwartzChronicles.com. And how about your stuff?
As usual, you can find my stuff at alanattridge.com and both of us at twohosers.com, where you can find links to our Flickr site for the above-mentioned, aforementioned photographs. You can find our Twitter stuff there, twohosers at Twitter. You can find my blog. There's anything you need to find, you can find it. twohosers.com.
Including coming soon, Two Hosers photo show coffee mugs.
That's very, we're on the edge of our seats. Everyone is, are they really going to make it happen?
Pre-orders coming soon.
Guaranteed to be a hot seller.
Yeah. Yes. Get them for Christmas time. Yeah.
Yep. You know, help probably put our kids through college.
Yeah.
What college? I don't know.
No.
So,
probably technical school, I think.
Potentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, the show's been derailed.
Yeah.
It's all-time low here.
Just finish it off.
Let's just finish it off. Until next week, get out there and make better photos.